Hello and welcome to New Netherland Praatjes, a series of chats on the Dutch colony of New Netherland, brought to you by the New Netherland Institute and the New Netherland Research Center in Albany, New York. Praatjes is Dutch for chat, and these are informal conversations with historians, archaeologists, and other experts on the world of the 17th century Dutch. Welcome again to New Netherland Praatjes. My name is Russell Shorto, and with me today is Mark Schamming. Mark is the director of the New York State Museum, a position he has held since 2012. And recently, very recently, he was named Deputy Commissioner for Cultural Education for New York, which, for those of you who are not savvy to these things, is a promotion. Am I correct, Mark?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. he has been intimately involved with New York history for a very long time and is integral to, among other things, the evolution of New Netherland studies. So, Mark, thank you very much for joining us.
Good. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into other details, maybe you can, I've been hanging around the New Netherland Institute since before it was the New Netherland Institute. Mm-hmm. I've been hanging around here a long time, and I cannot keep straight how things fit within the bureaucracy. You got the New Netherland Institute, the New Netherland Research Center, the New York State Library, the New York State Archives.
Yes.
The New York State Museum.
Right.
Can you just give us a quick
tour? Sure.
Because people who listen to this podcast, by and large, are
right.
fans of the NNI. And,
yes.
you know, maybe a little bureaucratic orientation.
So, first of all, there's three sister institutions are the New York State Museum, the State Archives, and State Library. State Library is the oldest sister, which dates to 1818. The New York State Museum began in 1836, and the State Archives in the 1970s. The NNI and the New Netherlands Institute, New Netherlands Research Center, are part of the New York State Library. As you know, the institute is sort of more the private function that supports all the great work that happens here at the New Netherlands Research Center and beyond, the programming and these sort of things. So under the roof of the Cultural Education Center, which is where we are all of these collections and entities.
So the Cultural Education Center describes the building as a whole.
Yes. Okay. So we're the building on the Empire State Plaza that houses all these great institutions, the research, the collections, mm-hmm. and all these things.
So interesting, you put dates to the founding of the museum and the library. That must make them among the oldest in the country.
Yes. Right? Yeah, certainly the State Library is among the oldest in the country. The State Museum is the oldest and largest state museum in the country.
Wow.
It predates the American Museum of Natural History and Smithsonian and others. It began as a natural history museum, and then in the 19th century began collecting ethnology, mm-hmm. history. In the mm-hmm. 20th century, it transformed itself into a modern museum.
Mm-hmm. So what's going on right now at the museum? Give us an idea of, like, this year, what exhibits, what programs?
Yeah, well, this is a big year, 2017, because there is three sort of anniversary celebration exhibitions. World War One, New York goes, America goes to war in 1917. So we are doing an exhibition about just that, particularly New York's involvement in World War One, and it involves collections and research from the library, the archives, and the museum as well. It's an enormous project, and there's probably 20-25 lenders.
And what kinds of artifacts?
There's the State Library has an incredible world-class poster collection. Mm-hmm. State Museum has everything from firearms and uniforms, medals, the personal objects. Mm-hmm. The archives has, of course, enlistment papers from many of them, including Henry Johnson, who was just awarded the Presidential Medal of Honor from Obama in 2015, mm-hmm. who was a New Yorker and actually lived in Albany. So it's an exhibition about all aspects of the war with a New York focus.
Mm-hmm. To use that one as an example of how an exhibit is developed, how long ago was that started?
That exhibition has been in development for about a year and a half.
Okay.
And
did somebody say, hey, 2017 is going to be the centenary of...
Well, we look ahead. We do a 3 to 4 year exhibition schedule and look at those special years that demark a year in history. Mm-hmm. So this has been on the books for a long time. So it comes as an idea. You think about the size and scale. You bring a team together and shape it. And we're now in the final days of installation. In fact, it opens on the 15th.
Okay.
The other two exhibitions are women's suffrage. The vote, women's vote in New York was passed in 1917 as well. So we're doing an exhibition about the suffrage movement. Mm-hmm. And again, the museum has tremendous collections, as does the library and archives, but we've gone across the state to borrow from other museums and collectors as well. Finally, Erie Canal. Mm-hmm. 1817 mm-hmm. Begins the construction of the Erie mm-hmm. Canal. So
that went on for 7 years
yeah.
or something like that.
Yeah, many, many years. Yeah. So we're doing a very large exhibition about the Erie Canal. Those three exhibitions are the largest in the state. We're doing the largest themed exhibitions on those three topics anywhere. There's some smaller ones going on.
Uh-huh. I imagine along the Erie Canal there are things going on.
There's things going along the canal. There's a canal conference, international conference happening in, I think, Rome, New York this uh-huh. fall. And the Canal Corporation's doing a bunch of things, but the center of it will be here.
Uh-huh. And there's an Ice Age exhibit?
Yes, we just opened. So, as you know,
people think New Netherland is the beginning of New York history. But
right. So there's a great exhibition on the Ice Age, what we call the Pleistocene, when the glaciers retreated from New York and mammals came. The State Museum is an enormously important Pleistocene mammal collection from the Ice Age, which dates back to about 11,000, 12,000 years ago, when actually humans came here as well, and the state was being occupied by Native Americans. So that's a great in-depth exhibition based on the research of our scientist here at the museum.
So that's actually the beginning of the history of Native Americans in New York.
Yeah, Native Americans were occupying, I'm told, around 13,000 years ago was the mm-hmm. beginning. Mm-hmm. In this part of the state, uh-huh. the glaciers are receding, which is forming the land and the rivers and those sort of things. And by
and making it
11,000, 11,000 years ago, they'd really taken up occupation here.
Uh-huh. And in progress is this renovation or reimagining of the New York exhibit.
Yes.
Give us a little background on that.
Well, we have a great museum, and we have many exhibitions that date from the 1970s when the museum was first opened, mm-hmm. right through exhibitions we have installed as soon as last year. So it's time to redo the exhibitions and tell a more comprehensive, more integrated story of New York.
So this is a permanent exhibit.
This is a permanent exhibition. Yeah. So everything right now, we have a large gallery that's about 30,000 square feet, which will tell a more integrated story about the natural and human history of New York State, probably starting from about 500 million years ago in continental drift when New York was below the equator. And then we'll do natural history stories of the flora and fauna that came after. And of course, then humans come when the native people arrive, settle the state, and the European contact, and the years beyond. It's a big story to tell. but we hope to tell a more integrated story. By that, I mean we don't want to have just a science hall, a Native American hall, and a white history hall. It's a much more integrated story mm-hmm. that we want to mm-hmm. That want to be able to tell. So it's going to be a whole other look at the state.
And I'm sure when in designing something like that, you give thought to, you know, how much time will the average visitor spend mm-hmm. going through it?
Yeah. Well, nobody. This is a large museum. We have 100,000 square feet on the first floor, so no person would come through and read 100,000 square feet of exhibition. So you want the exhibits to stand alone and have a real message and link to the next. Mm-hmm. So if you visit any part of the museum, it would be a complete experience. Also, you say permanent exhibitions. We're designing the whole museum so it can be changeable. So nothing's permanent. Mm. Some things may be more short term and long term, but just because we're constantly having new collections and new knowledge, want to be able to update and change the exhibitions whenever we can. So we're going to use less sheetrock and more movable walls and cases.
Okay,
that
that's what I was going to ask. What makes it more changeable? Physically, the way you don't cement it into
the... Correct. So it's exactly that. There's some icons like the mastodon and the dioramas.
Yeah,
they stay.
Yeah.
We're not moving those. People will come and see them. However, if you come to see the story about the human occupation or the European settlement of the state and immigration and that kind of thing, we'd be able to change, add artifacts, you'd come back again and again and be somewhat of a different experience every mm-hmm. time. And some of the galleries, we have five changing galleries as we program now, and that would continue. Mm-hmm. So we do changing exhibits as well.
So the new, quote, permanent New York yeah. exhibit, how do you conceptually, I mean, what needs to be updated conceptually?
Right. Well, there's a lot in terms of natural history. We know a lot more about the state now than they did in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. The museum has been collecting and researching all parts of the natural history of the state, the paleontology and biology and geology and that sort of thing. We also have many, many more collections and studies about that tell us about how Native peoples occupied the state, how they moved across the state, the early nomadic people that settled here and where they stayed. We've done, and we have our researchers in prehistory studying artifacts that were dug up even in the 70s and 80s. They're still studying that material. So we have a better picture of that. Mm-hmm. We also have a much better picture, we think, of the European settlement than the Native American contact with the Dutch and then the English that followed and on. So that story hasn't been told well in this and any museum, really, I think, mm-hmm. in an in-depth way. Mm-hmm. So we have many, many more collections now than we mm-hmm. did 10, 15 years ago, mm-hmm. and much more knowledge as well.
Okay, so since you brought up the Dutch, the NNI is all about giving that colony its rightful place in yes. American colonial history.
Yeah.
How do you translate that into museum speak, into an exhibit?
Well, we're just wading into this now, but I'll tell you what the thoughts are. Mm-hmm. First of all, this is the first time that we've utilized all these collections that we have, both in the archives, which is all the great documents that Charlie Gehring and Yanni have been translating for over 40 years. Mm-hmm. The museum now has over 90,000 artifacts of New Netherland from New Amsterdam to Beverwijk in the Hudson Valley. And we have historic, vast amount of historic archaeology that can help now tell this story. So we think, first of all, there's an important story to talk about the contact between the native peoples that were here and the Dutch when they first came and how that impacted both those cultures. Jim Bradley's going to work on that with us. We have great collections that illustrate this kind of thing. And I think many of our visitors who come to the museum, first of all, don't understand the native people are still here. Mm-hmm. And they don't understand fully how the state, New York State, is different than other states and that were settled by the Dutch and it became a more complicated British colony and so on and so forth. So it's finally the moment, we think, to tell that story mm-hmm. In a much more expansive way. We, our thing is we always think of what does a visitor come away with, presuming the visitor has no information
right. That
they come here and think that there was Indians here until 1609 and then the Dutch came and no one's talking about the Indians and then the British. But it's a much more complicated story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is, in general, the challenge of New York history that
yes. Compared
to other places, maybe you disagree, New York's history, the city, of course, but the state as well,
yeah.
is so complicated, is characterized by this interaction of so many different peoples, native and different Europeans, and that's a challenge right through in the quote Dutch period, but then again in the Revolutionary period, the New York story is more complicated, I think, than other areas, mm-hmm. and in the Civil War.
Yes.
And you might say still today, what is New York state identity?
Right.
How does that?
Yeah, because we have downstate, because we have New York, and then the larger word upstate. However, Albany is very different than Buffalo.
Sure.
And Binghamton, Utica, and Syracuse. Mm-hmm. And you don't tell it in a snapshot. Mm-hmm. So that it's going to be a project to distill down these stories and tell them. And again, it'd be impossible in any museum to have a comprehensive story with every detail of every part of the state
right. Over
these years. So how does one come away and understand that there's this complicated history? Mm-hmm. Well, New York, there was a defining history, I think, to it, that we have to tell this very early history. And then, of course, there's immigration, the people that came through from Europe and many places and occupied the state, and why we think we're different from New England and the South and the Mid-South and the West. So it's a challenge. We're depending not only on museum knowledge and researchers and curators, but looking out to historians across the state to help us tell the story as well.
So you've got this one central, there will be this one central exhibition that tries to take on all of that, and then surely there will be pieces of that story that you focus on at different times and try to highlight.
You know, the idea is it's going to roughly be in a chronological order.
Yeah.
Through what's now the Adirondack Hall, as I said, going back about 500 million years ago, you know, you fast forward to the occupation of the state by humans and so on. So an arc around about half of New York Hall will be changed as well. Mm-hmm. So the idea is, and the challenge here is you enter the museum from a couple of different ways. You would either enter from the 20th century and work back or from 500 years ago and work forward. Mm. So.
And back to the New Netherland period, and in a museum sense, if people are used to conceiving of New Netherland from the printed word, what can the museum, how can it, you know, fill in that? How can it give you a sort of three-dimensional sense of what the colony was?
Well, you know, when you do exhibition, well, we always start as one with a book, with a story, right? So we want to say the story of, here's the contact, here's the arrival of these people and how they lived. And then you look for the artifacts and images to tell that story. Mm-hmm. The great thing in a museum is some very small objects can have tremendous resonance, you know, because these are actual pieces that were touched by history, that were there, that were used by these actual people, and tell these compelling stories. Mm-hmm. So, you know, with exhibitions, we use large architectural components, whether we make them or have them. We're looking out to borrow some examples. You know, we have 90,000 pieces of New Netherlands in our collection, which all came from underground. So they're pieces of things. You know, there's some... some pieces are whole, but more or less, these are archaeological. It's evidence,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So we're beginning the very beginning stages of looking out, even possibly to some lenders in Amsterdam that would give us examples of things. If you have a portion of a plate or a glass or something, we would borrow the actual complete.
So you have the piece and then the whole to show. Yeah.
Yeah, but still using these objects, you can tell tremendous stories with some of the smallest. Pieces as well.
And so this is all very much it's in the creative phase right now.
Yeah. So we're just beginning the thread of working out the story. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, historic archaeologists are literally cataloging a Fort Orange collection that we just brought in. And they're still working on what we call South Street Seaport, the New Amsterdam collection. Yeah. So we're getting
The Fort Orange collection that was just brought in. What do you mean just brought in?
Okay. So, in 1970, Paul Huey did the dig at Fort Orange, and the collection went to Parks at the time. And Paul worked heroically over the years to catalog what he could and do and studied this collection. And he photographed the sites. I don't know if you've seen these images. Mm-hmm. He even filmed it. Mm-hmm. About 2 years ago, we began exploring through channels with Parks, where that collection is at Peebles Island, to take it into the State Museum. Paul's retired, even though he's doing a lot of great work still. We thought it should join our New Netherlands collection, and it filled an enormously important gap. Mm-hmm. So this past fall, Parks transferred about 70,000 artifacts to the State Museum from Fort Orange. And it now joins our larger collection. Schuyler Flatt's collection as well came to us. So we now have the most important New Netherlands archaeology collection anywhere. Some of it was it's a vast collection, wasn't even cataloged at the time. Paul's been in, he's been coming in and looking at it with us, and we've got a team of historic archaeologists and techs looking at it and photographing and cleaning and finding some just amazing things.
So you're kind of at the early stages of, say, what do we have here?
Yes.
And then
yes.
as you start to understand it better,
right.
figure out, okay, how can we tell a story using this object or this collection of them?
Yeah. Exactly. And so we're learning something about that collection every day, and that's going to go on, I'm sure, through the exhibition development process.
Yeah, which is how long until when?
Well, we're going to phase the new galleries. It's going to take about 3 years because the museum stays open. You can't shut the whole museum down, tear the galleries down. So we'll do it in probably three parts. Mm-hmm. So it's going to take 3 to 4 years to get it all done, and we're just figuring out now what those pieces are. Mm-hmm. But to the Fort Orange collection and New Netherlands, the great thing again, because we have in this building in this area people like Paul Huey, Charlie Yanni, Mike Lucas, our historic archaeologist, and his team, for the first time working together to tell this story. In the late 80s, there was sort of a false start. We were going to do Beverwijk in a bakery, and that exhibit never happened. So this has sort of been on the shelf waiting to go. And I'm, in a way, in many ways, I'm glad we waited to do it because of the collections, what we have and what we know. That we can really, I think, do an even better.
So there's now a lot of there's the will and there's money, presumably.
Yes.
And there's this sort of integrated sensibility that you're bringing people from the different backgrounds.
Yeah. And we have a perfect space for the new Netherlands Gallery. We're blocking out. It's the gallery adjacent to Native Peoples, which brings you to contact. So the next threshold you would step into is 1609, and then Fort Orange, and then
from Henry Hudson, right?
Yeah,
right.
Through. And then we talk about New Amsterdam and New Netherlands and so on.
Yeah, tremendous. And then I interrupted you, but you were then going on to talk about the South Street Seaport collection.
Yes, South Street Seaport came to us in 2005. It's a very large collection. I forgot the numbers. I mean, maybe it's in excess of a million pieces, of which about 20,000 are 17th century Dutch. Artifacts from Lower Manhattan. So they've joined this collection as well, as I said, with Fort Orange and Schuyler Flats.
And they have been, where they have they been just in drawers and things like that since
it
then?
It was in storage at the South Street Seaport for several or many years since the digs. I think they, I'd have to look, happened in the 70s or 80s.
Yeah.
And again, that collection needs to be fleshed out as well, but there's some great stuff there. So
this is a lot of work for people. A lot of people have to
We have historic archaeology staff, including archaeologists and technicians, and they spend every day cleaning and cataloging and studying. You know all these pieces, and they're making just great connections. Mm-hmm. And the great thing again is they have Charlie, Garing, and Yanni here that they can talk to. So we're going to bring people like you and Charlie and everybody in to help tell us fuller story.
Do you have any examples that come to mind of, you know, pieces that fill in a gap or?
Yeah, you know, there's some very specific things. For instance, there was this tavern on the edge of Fort Orange called the, how do you say apple in Dutch?
Oppel.
Very close. Tavern. And it was apparently, there was a privy and everything went into this moat that was around Fort Orange. And we have these objects now where Charlie has and Yanni have translated documents that make a reference to this an understanding about this very tavern. So these could be very modest, broken, you know, mugs and pieces of glass and pipes and these sort of thing. Some of the interesting artifacts, you find trade beads, glass trade beads that came from the Netherlands. And some of those, by the way, we find at Indian sites 100 miles from here, which speaks to this trade and contact that was that was going on.
Yeah.
They're very excited. There's some pipe stems that they'd never seen before in New York or upstate and so on. So
that's great. I actually have, it's probably not legal for me to have, but I have Leo Hershkowitz, the historian, was hanging out in Lower Manhattan. I think he was a grad student in the 60s when they were digging some of the foundations of buildings down there. And they were apparently just throwing stuff out at the time. Uh-huh. And he, having some awareness of it, grabbed things and built up this whole collection. And he once gave me a brick from New Amsterdam.
Oh, really?
And so I have it. And I brought it actually to the because they used it as ballast. It was made in the Netherlands.
Right.
And I brought it to the city archaeologist in Amsterdam, and I showed it to him. He knew immediately where it was from. It was from Drenthe, from this part of the country.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, you know, I had brought it back home.
You know, and actually from Fort Orange, we probably have 50 boxes of bricks.
Yeah.
And exactly that. Somebody would tell, Charlie just told me they were trying to figure out exactly from where they came from the Netherlands.
Yeah,
over,
by the clay or whatever.
Yeah.
Can tell.
But you brought it back to
I still have it. I mean, I brought it back to show him, but I kept it.
Yeah, leave it there.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's talk about, you've been in the job as director of the museum since 2012.
Right.
Can you give us some highlights of your time there?
As director of the museum? We've taken in some great collections, not that I've been out there collecting, We've brought staff together in a more integrated way. For instance, our historic archaeologists now work with our historians. Believe it or not, the history unit was a very separate thing in the past, and now they're working together. It's not just the archaeologists look at the broken stuff, and the historians have the complete things. The exhibition teams have been building in a much healthier way. Mm-hmm. We have increased funding in several collecting areas. Mm. We collect contemporary Native American material that had been stopped, and we restarted that. So our ethnologist, and we have a new ethnologist out there. We have, in the last 5 years, made somewhere between 25 and 30 hires. We've rebuilt the staff, and especially in the curatorial areas in history and the archaeology section and science as well. And exhibits, so across the board. Mm-hmm. So that's been very important. In 2007 and 8, when everything took a dip, we lost a number of positions.
Yeah.
Fought very hard to rebuild the museum. Uh-huh. We've done that. Uh-huh. The commissioner and the regents were in a great place with them, and they've given us many more resources.
And when you start in a position like that, do you start with kind of a master plan, or are you just stepping into what had been and trying to keep it going? Or?
I'll tell you what I did. I came to the museum in 1987. So I've been here 30 years now. Mm-hmm. I had been here 25 years.
Could have an exhibit, your 30-year exhibit of your time here.
So I came on out of exhibits. I started as an exhibit designer. I went to art school. And when I started on the first month, I started taking tours of all of the parts of the museum that I didn't manage, all the research and collection parts, and asked the staff to treat me like I was here for the first time. Just show me your stuff. And within a week, I realized what I didn't know. I mean, this is a vast place. We have over 16 million artifacts. We have research that's been going on.
How many people are employed here?
We have, I think, 138 in the museum. And these include the scientific, the research and collections, history, the exhibition education staff, and production staff as well, which is a large staff.
Sure.
And I knew all these people and research and collections and science and certainly history, but I hadn't seen what they do. Mm-hmm. So I spent my first 6 months touring every curator, looking at every collection. And the more you see, the more you realize you don't know. This place is vast, and it's sort of overwhelming. And it gave me a very different perspective about the history of this museum, the lineage of it. They're still, as I may have said, they're studying artifacts that were collected in the 1830s and comparing them to things now. It's not an easy place to step into and direct because it's just that big, right? But I got to know it as well as possible and listen to the curators and where we had needs and, again, try to fund and build back these curatorial areas and got people working together on teams with the educators and the exhibition staff and planning staff, and it's gone very well. Mm-hmm. So it was about a year into it, we started seeing the opportunity for two things. One is to get the funds to rebuild the galleries, to redesign the galleries. So the museum worked together on a master plan with Gallagher and Associates to do that. And we began the planning for a new collection facility that's underway. We have a $60 million bond to build a new collection facility off-site. So those are the two big things we wanted to see happen.
Because right now everything's here?
No. Well, there's many of the museum collections are in the Cultural Education Center, but about 4 million objects in Rotterdam in an off-site facility, about 80,000 square feet. Uh-huh. So that building would be replaced. It's a World War I era shed that we keep history collections and geology collections in. So we're at the very beginnings of developing a new collection facility. So I want to see that done. Mm-hmm. That's going to take several years to have that happen as well. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so your new role. Deputy Commissioner for Cultural Education,
yes.
and this I copied from I forget where. You will oversee the Office of Cultural Education, which includes the State Museum, New York State Archives, and the New York State Library, which put me in mind of Donald Trump naming Jared Kushner, giving him oversight of Europe, the Middle East, Asia, and
it's
rebuilding
big,
America's infrastructure.
Right.
So how do you, you know, are you working, I guess you're working that out now.
Yes.
How to do all that.
Yes. So I stepped into that position. It was vacant for some number of months as deputy commissioner, and they appointed me on March 13th. Very much as I looked at the museum, and at this point I'm still director of the museum, and I'm deputy commissioner. We have great leadership in the library and archives. And actually, there's another unit called Educational Television and Summer School for the Arts. This is all within cultural ed. Mm. And I'm treating it as the day I stepped into directorship of the museum. I'm trying to get to every corner of the building and see the collections and the staff and the functions and everything we do. And it's even more vast than just looking at the museum. There's some tremendous special collections in the library. The archives has an enormous repository of material from New York State.
Right.
We have staff across the board doing both research and administrative functions. And again, I think, and this is a very good moment, given these projects at hand, bringing these people across the institution to work on these projects. In fact, the Erie Canal suffrage and World War I involved people from all parts of cultural education, the library, the archives, and the museum.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're really bringing these collections together in new ways, many times for the first time.
So you will continue in your function as director of the museum?
Yeah, at this point, I will.
Uh-huh.
You know, nobody's anything forever, but
right.
I'm not stepping off from that at this point. There's a lot of big projects underway.
Yeah,
as we talked about, the large gallery project and the collections facility and, uh-huh. and these sort of things. So moving ahead on both of all of these fronts.
Mm-hmm. Just backing up on your timeline, I was going to touch on, you brought up the fact that your training is in the fine arts.
Mm-hmm.
And you came into museum studies by way of...
Yeah, I came on as an exhibit designer. I have an MFA in fine arts.
Mm-hmm.
From
where?
UAlbany.
Okay.
And I have an undergraduate, I have a BFA in fine arts from Buffalo State College.
Mm-hmm.
So I came on as an exhibit designer in 1987,
mm-hmm.
working on Native peoples in New York, and then a variety of things. In fact, I worked with Charlie, I think, in 1988 on Beaverwijk. I did the concept drawings for that with him back then, before mm-hmm. that stopped. Mm-hmm. And I came on a whole wave of people retired and left at the time I was at Commerce Ave, the production facility years ago was offsite, and made my way through supervisory and management functions. Mm-hmm. I've always maintained a hand in designing some exhibits or planning exhibitions. And I'm in all of these roles.
Mm-hmm.
I still do draw things at times.
Mm-hmm.
So I became director of exhibitions, I think, in 1995, and worked that job until I became director of the museum in 2012.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know, maybe it's, I don't know how common it is for mm-hmm. someone in your position to have that kind of background, but I think there's something very useful in that, right?
Well, I hope so. I'm only the 13th director of the State Museum. And I'm the first one with an art degree.
Okay, very interesting. So they're only 13. So some of them stuck around for
yes.
a good while.
Yeah, the first director was James Hall. He worked for the museum for 61 years. He was director for 23.
Okay.
He was the first state paleontologist, first state geologist. And actually, he was famous for whipping members of the legislature with a switch for funds. And he was said to have kept a handgun at his desk or something. Yeah. So he was quite the character. He's famous. All paleontologists know who James Hall is. But none of them had
My son wants to be a paleontologist.
Oh, he does. Yeah. Well, he can come visit our state paleontologist yeah. here, Lisa Amati.
Yeah.
Who can,
he's seven.
Show them well, okay. He might have it in the blood. And when I became director, I had worked with many of the scientists and certainly the historians for a long time. And mm-hmm. there might have been a little nervousness at first that there wasn't a scientist at the helm.
Uh-huh.
But we're in a great place yeah. and they know science is one of the great priorities of the museum.
Sure, sure. But I assume you would agree that having that, your background gives you a distinctive way of approaching the job.
I would agree. Yes.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I draw a lot in the margins of my notes at meetings, and they'll tend to see this. We've done many art exhibitions, and actually we're building new art collections in history.
But even, I mean, any exhibition is... It's a visual thing.
It is. And maybe unlike other directors, I've always maintained sort of an art directorship over designs and things that we do. We have an incredible design staff, and they show me everything, because I love to see it. I don't micromanage them,
mm-hmm.
but I've always had a hand in the visual nature of the museum, mm-hmm. which I love, and I've always had good working relationships with them.
Because you're presenting information in a visual way, and that's...
Yeah.
There's such a thing as doing it well or doing it
correct.
Better.
And you know when it's bad.
Yeah.
And I like to think we do it very well.
Uh-huh. Do the role that you are now in, do other states have that equivalence to that?
We looked around. I was looking around when I was thinking about being museum director in the deputy commissioner position. And I don't know of another state that has this relationship of a state library, archives, and museum,
right,
and a department within an education department that's cultural education. Yeah. It's really unique.
Okay. It's divided up in other places.
It's divided up. Some states have a state museum. Some don't. They'll just have historic. Some have a state museum that's a science museum. I think it's North Carolina. Some places, the state museum is under their Department of State or their the state department within a state. The other great thing is we're within the state education department. Mm-hmm. And I have a great working relationship with Governor Cuomo and his staff. I've done a lot of work with him in the Capitol and across the state. But there's something really important about being within a state education department, just in terms of, I think, freedom of thought, a lineage of a museum to exist over years and years and years and not be involved with politics.
Mm-hmm.
There's a purity to that.
In what way are you—so you're not involved with politics?
Well, no. I mean, we're not guided by politics. I mean, we work for elected regents who appoint a commissioner. So we would operate under, I mean, funding always comes through the governor's office.
And so funding is politics.
Well, it is. And by the way, we've done great under Governor Cuomo. He likes the museum. He's been here often. Mm-hmm. We've done great projects out. Mm-hmm. You don't know what the next governor is going to be.
Sure.
So there's some symmetry or purity, I think, about being within the state education department.
Mm-hmm.
We've been under the regents since 1845, before there was a state education department.
Mm-hmm.
The museum has been under.
So you don't interact with your people in equivalent positions in other states because they kind of
don't
exist.
I've met the last director of the New Jersey State Museum, for instance. But I don't interact with other state museum directors as such. I mean, we work with museums across state and country.
This, I guess, relates in a way to New York's uniqueness, its own history and how it has developed.
I think so, and it's important to the state, you know, and the place.
Yeah. Your role is one of public history.
Yes.
How, you know, there's, I guess people can divide history into academic and public,
right,
and both are important, but, you know, speak to the importance of public history and public history, maybe especially now in an age when people are, you know, talking about fake news
and isn't that an interesting corollary?
And when people are, you know, so able seemingly to kind of roll over the past or reinvent the past, you know, for political purposes or whatever.
Yeah, well, as you know, the term public history is a relatively recent thing. We've always had the academy and great historians, particularly in New York State. And it's, you know, just at the baseline, another way to deliver history. One's a writer. It's a platform. Museums tell history in a more public way. And so we have these historians who are actually studying history in this way that's applicable in a way that you can tell and show history in a more maybe accessible way to the public, which is terribly important. And a number of our historians now have public history degrees and have studied history in this way.
Mm-hmm.
We also work directly with literally this thing called the New York Academy, Ken Jackson and that group, which is very important. There's great writers and historians, you know, across the state. But I think history is told and said and exhibited and written in, you know, very different ways now, and certainly respected. And I think the museum roles has changed enormously even in the last 15, 20 years in that way.
How?
Because, you know, in the past, one would do history exhibits of objects. You know, you do an exhibit of chairs.
Mm-hmm.
Now we don't do that. We talk about maybe the social history of chairs, right? Our portfolios of our historians are different now. We used to have a chair curator and automobile curator and so on, and the portfolios are different now. We do social history and military history, and within that are these artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have fine art that overlaps with a military historian and so on. So it's not, if you follow me, we're not, we don't divide thinking about history and objects by an index of kinds of collections, but more of thoughtful topics and themes that make more of a sense, I think, to talk about the fabric of history.
That's the way, I mean, that's I was, when I lived in Amsterdam for a while, I was on the board of the Rijksmuseum. Mm-hmm. And that was, and they have not too long ago reopened it. And it's this spectacular place now. And the question, the debate was about how to integrate historical artifacts and art. And, you know, I guess on the face of it, it might seem like a simple thing.
Right.
But it, you know, it's sort of case by case, you have to figure out what are you doing here and what kind of story are you telling and how are you using these objects together.
Yeah.
So I guess that's the sort
of
thing.
That's inspirational. And I saw that. I was at the Rijksmuseum in November and saw the very same thing. I mean, there's a Night Watch in that great gallery of the heroic paintings of the Netherlands and Rembrandt. But it's spectacular, I think, how they use this material culture with art.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Nova Zembla and then the paintings. And you weren't seeing just an art exhibit. I can say that. You were seeing an exhibit enhanced by this material culture. I think that adds tremendous texture and fabric. And there's an organic sense of what you're looking at that's very different. I think that's beautifully done.
And it breaks down these divisions, these artificial divisions. And this is art with a capital A. And,
exactly.
You know.
Right. So you would use art to tell these stories as much as you would use material.
But it comes with built-in problems. You know, I remember some discussion about mid-20th century mixing like art paintings with a concentration camp outfit like that a prisoner would wear. And it was like, there was some discussion of like, well, the stripes is weird.
I guess there could be some lines anywhere.
Exactly. I think there are times when things fit together or you have to say, wait a second.
In fact, 9/11 would be an example. Uh-huh. There's some art made at that time and about it that is really interesting to look at, art that was made right at that time and responding to it. It could go over the line to be, you know, something that was either inappropriate or kind of not a great connection.
Right.
A curator had made an artist out of it. So there's always that risk.
Right.
But still, I mean, it's pretty interesting if you see what art was being made in the 1940s while this terrible thing was happening. And then these connections.
Sure. There's ways to do it, ways to integrate it. Yeah. You brought up 9/11, and I see in your resume this series of photographs that I guess you took from the World Trade Center.
Yes.
Talk a bit about that?
Yeah. After the attacks of 9/11, and I was director of exhibitions at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I got together with the curators and we knew we wanted to address this or do something about it. The question was, do you collect something or do you document it or whatnot? And in early October, we went to New York and had a large meeting at the Museum of the City in New York. And people were there from the Smithsonian, the City and Port Authority, and just trying to figure out what to do. And the city museums were sort of paralyzed in the city. In early November, I was given access to the World Trade Center site with the Port Authority and went with a small group to advise the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey what they might save, because they said, we should save some steel or something because there may be a museum or memorial someday. So we went in and it was just kind of a cold day in November. And we went into the site and it was just sort of stunning. We didn't even have any suggestions. It was so overwhelming.
Yeah.
It was the place was still burning. And we learned at that time that everything was leaving the World Trade Center site and going to Fresh Kills Landfill on Staten Island. Everything from the site, by barge and by ship, the FBI was escorting out to this recovery operation on Staten Island. So we asked for and got access about 2 weeks later to a place called Fresh Kills Landfill. And over the next 10 months, I spent about 40 days there. And after some couple of weeks, gained the confidence of the FBI and the New York Police Department, and they let me start photographing it. I mean, I shot one day at Ground Zero, but I probably shot about 900 photographs at the recovery operation. So literally everything came from the site every day by ship. And it was at the height about 1,500 FBI agents there searching through this every day. And that's where our collections came from. By late December, they began setting things aside for us.
Mm.
They were looking for human remains and pieces of personal property. And we started photographing and collecting this other historical significant material.
Mm-hmm.
So by the end of the summer, we had collected somewhere around 20 tons of materials, including steel and about 75 pieces of the planes, vehicles, pieces of unidentified personal property. That all came to be in the collection of the State Museum by the following fall. Mm-hmm. So the photographs that I have, I did the most comprehensive photo documentation of the recovery operation.
That's what I was going to ask you. Yeah. What you were self-consciously doing was documenting this whole effort.
Yeah, because the FBI wasn't even really documenting it. We were working very close with them. I mean, they had some photographs of this and that, and they were taking shots of some of the personal property. Mm-hmm. But nobody was photographing the operation, which we did. And by the end of the summer, the whole thing was done. There was about 1 million tons of World Trade Center underground. Mm-hmm. They had found, I think, about 5,000 or 6,000 pieces of human remains, probably over 25,000 pieces of personal property, and it sifted through 1.8 million tons of the Trade Center. So moving ahead, we have a gallery now in the museum. We've loaned and exhibited things across the country and across Europe as well. And we worked very closely with the FBI to understand our collections, to help tell the story, family members. And eventually the museum was organized at the site. So some of our material went back on loan to them. Mm-hmm. And the photographs, my negatives now are in the state archives because they collect photography and store it kind of in a better way than the museum could. Mm-hmm.
So this then was an exhibit, the photographs.
Yeah. So there was a photograph, the exhibit of the photographs at New York Historical Society, and there was a traveling exhibit of them that went around the country with some artifacts. Mm-hmm. Over some several years. And they're used in the gallery here about the recovery operation.
Tremendous.
Yeah.
All right. I guess perhaps final question. This is an era in which, there's a lot of effort in the part of the government to defund culture, arts. How do you see yourself in that context? Are you a defender of these kinds of institutions?
Yeah, of course. It's really the spine of what we do.
Yeah.
We're staunch supporters of the NEH and the NEA and IMLS. The State Library receives direct funding from IMLS for many of the programs that we do. It's, I think, a civilized country funds these sort of things. It's history and art and culture. The idea that it would be defunded is just horrific. I think it's a sign of a civilized country, and frankly, there should be more of it. And the fact that it's such a small amount of our federal budget, and it doesn't seem to me that this administration wants to defund it to save money. It's the idea of defunding it, which is even more destructive than it.
Yourself in your position taking any active role in?
In my position, the department's talking a lot about the impact of loss of federal funding, particularly to the state library and across the state. And of course, it's the education department, so it has great impact there.
Sure.
So we're working with the department and within the department as they go to Washington and make the plea to.
So on the one hand, you have to act defensively, but on the other hand, you're presumably on the offensive making pleas or making stands or...
Yes. I mean, within the state, in my job within work, they ask for something else to be part of it, and we do that. So the department are staunch supporters of keeping these agencies intact, keeping the funding going.
Right.
So there are some steps. I mean, I'm glad we're New Yorkers. I think the state is stepping up in a great way. I don't know they can fill in for all of this. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the great things about being a New Yorker these days to me. And we just hope it's an enlightened government that sees its way through this national tragedy.
So I'm hearing a kind of mixed messages from you as you move into this new position. You are very positive about this institution and what it's capable of and the support it will get in the future. And at the same time, there's this kind of cloud hanging overhead.
Yeah. Sure. So as in my job and as part of New York State government and state education, we're moving forcefully on many fronts and doing great things. But does that, you know, fear or grayness hang there that everyone's worried about, or we're worried about in the world of culture and art and museums? Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be realistic about it. On the same hand, I think one of the things you can do is not to just stop and I mean, you resist or demonstrate in a way, but you do good things, you do real things that have outcomes. And so we're just pushing it every place we can, if that makes sense.
Sure,
I think we have to succeed at the best things that we do, and they matter to people. Yeah. I have to think that way ultimately.
On that note, Mark Schamming, now Deputy Commissioner for Cultural Education and Director of the State Museum. Thank you.
Thank you, Russell.